Now, the next point to discuss as we approach the 12 links is the two levels of causality that happen in the world. The first is what the Dalai Lama calls natural causality. So this is the cause and effect process that is the arising of our bodies and minds through natural causes, like our bodies exist in dependence upon the food and drink that we've taken, depends upon our genes and the continuum of consciousness, as well as things occurring in the environment. So first of all, our bodies, just our mere body, comes from natural causes. Our mind naturally arises. You can't say that mind itself is a result of karma. Mind is a continuum. It's a result of itself. You know, the past moment, present moment, future moment. Similarly with the bodies. This is a cause and effect chain, which isn't karma. Things occurring in the environment, as a result of the physical properties of matter, the chemical activity, electromagnetic, gravitational forces, and so on. The growth of plants, rain, winds, tides, volcanoes, earthquakes. All of these events occur as a result of natural cause and effect. They're not the direct result of karma. Now, karmic causality is clearly related to sentient beings. So, specifically, when we talk about karma, we refer to the mental factor of intention, the purpose behind actions. So there can be, deliberately conscious actions or subconscious actions, physical, verbal, or mental. And these actions, which we call karma, when the action has happened, the intended action has happened, then as it finishes, this, we're talking about the duration, the time when the intended action, whatever it is, finishes and stops, because everything's changing moment by moment, it establishes upon the mind stream what we call a karmic potency. So the potency itself, we don't call karma. Karma, the term karma refers to the action, the intended action. But this is a karmic potency. So this means it is an impermanent phenomenon which changes moment by moment. It belongs to that category of things which are neither mind nor form. In a general way, it's said to be established upon the mind stream. In a more specific way, we talk about it is established upon the mere I, or the mere person. So, the mere I, or the mere person, refers to the person who exists in dependence upon labeling upon the body and mind. And when we look at the basis of the label in a more subtle context, the most subtle aspect of our body and the most subtle aspect of our mind is what we call this eternal drop, which is a combination. Well, it is an entity which is said to abide at the level of the heart chakra. It is called clear light because the experience of the mind is clear light, and the wind which supports that mind is the clear light wind. So this also is an ever-changing phenomenon. It has one function of movement, which we label wind, and it has one function of awareness, which we label mind. So this is what really comes down to the final basis of labeling of the person. It is the most subtle body and mind. And it's one entity which has these two functions. So it is the actual meeting of body and mind. And in being such as cells, his minds are contaminated by karma and so on, that most subtle wind can become more coarse and eventually give rise to the gross physical body, and the most subtle clear light mind becomes more coarse and gives rise to our human consciousness with all of its qualities. So Robert Thurman, I don't know if you've heard of Robert Thurman, the father of Uma Thurman. I don't know who is more famous, Robert or his daughter, Uma. Anyway, Robert is a great, really incredible scholar of Buddhism. I think he was the first Westerner to take ordination in the Tibetan tradition back in the 1960s. And he'd already met His Holiness, he'd learned Tibetan, and had amazing personal instruction from His Holiness on the most profound teachings of Lama Tsongkhapa, and so on. The only problem is his English language. He chooses the most obscure words. I mean, they're obscure to me. They're accurate. They're really accurate. But boy, they're a mouthful. Anyway, he says, if we want to use the term soul, like Buddhism, in Hindu beliefs, and I think in Judeo-Christian, Arabic beliefs, Islamic beliefs, there is a soul which is a permanent, unchanging entity which, you know, survives death and goes to heaven or hell. And so Thurman says, if you want to use the term soul, then you can call this eternal drop the soul, because it is beginningless. There's no time when it was created. It has been flowing through time without beginning, but it has always been contaminated by confusion, ignorance, and the results of ignorance, anger, attachment, pride, jealousy, and karmic potencies. So, at death, as we've talked about, the mind contracts right down to the clear light mind, the wind becomes a clear light wind, and this eternal drop at the moment. Now, maybe days, many days after we stop breathing, technically we're still alive because the eternal drop is still here at the heart chakra. But when it eventually separates from the old body and mind, that's the final moment of death. And so in the next moment, then due to the ripening, or the karma that had ripened during death, then it manifests as the between body and mind. This is another Robert Thurmanism. The bardo, we usually call it the in-between state, but he calls it the between state, between death and rebirth. Even when I'm reading it, I slip in an in. Okay. So that is the final basis of imputation of the person. The mere I, the merely imputed person. And so you see, as this continues from life to life, then we'd say this, we can't say that me, the person of this life, I'm not responsible for karmic actions created by a person in a previous life, because that wasn't me. But it wasn't the gross me, but it was the mere eye, the subtle eye, imputed upon the eternal drop, the most subtle wind of mind. So here, you see, we do see that karma can only, karmic potencies can only ripen and bring an experience on the continuum person of the mere eye who created them. And so this is this connection. Yeah. During that time in the between state is what?
So we've just seen in the discussion that we are in a constant state of flux. We are changing, we are not the same entity
at
any given moment.
Yeah. I think during that state, the between existence, Bardo existence, that is a result of the karma which had ripened for the future life, which ripened as we were dying. I have it. There is the mere eye. The mere eye is able. It is a more subtle existence, the winds are more coarse, the mind is more coarse, but the body doesn't have sense organs in the intermediate state. The visual and sensory experiences are all perceived by the mental consciousness. Mental consciousness does have the capacity to be aware of the sense objects. So you can, it may be well mentioned in the text that as this is caused by the same karma for the future life, it belongs to the person of the future life. But still, and there is a person in the Bardo, in the between state, because there is a mere, the clear light mind and clear light wind are also there. You probably wouldn't say it is the person of the future life because you haven't been born into the actual body. But it does have the appearance of the future life's body. Like if the karma to be human had ripened during death, then it will have the shape of a human body. If it was to be an animal, it will look like an animal body, and so on. Does that answer your question? I didn't.
I think it was more about whether, because of our karmas, we are getting modified.
Modified.
So really my question was, are we in a position, this designated eye or body, or I don't know what to call it, whatever it is, does it at that time also have that ability to keep modifying? Because it is,
there is a potential one can achieve enlightenment in the between state. One can even change one's karmic projection to rebirth and go to a pure land if one knows how, which is not easy. Or if one has the karma and one has a qualified guru, a lama who can do meditation, their practice can intervene with our karmic destiny and send the intermediate state being to a pure land to complete their practice. So that's possible. So yes, it can be modified, but one has to be an extremely qualified meditator to do it. Lama Tsongkhapa is said to have achieved enlightenment in the Bardo, in the between them.
Does the job?
I'm not sure about just how you mentioned about the internal job. Is it from the mind which rise come out to the
left? The eternal job?
Yeah. So is it from the mind?
From the mind?
It is, mind is there, mind is, it is the most, the clear light experience is the most subtle, most profound mental experience, right?
Is it abstract?
I'm going deaf. And the air conditioning makes it hard to hear.
What I say that is the control, what's the meaning of the control?
Maybe you can elaborate more on what is an internal control. He is not very clear whether it is mind or what.
Okay. This presentation, a human being has gross, subtle, and very subtle mind, and gross, subtle, and very subtle body. The gross body and mind, this, you know, gross body that we know of, and the gross consciousness, the eye awareness, the five senses, and our mental consciousness, our thoughts and emotions, and so on. So when we're awake, the gross mind is functioning, it depends on the gross body. Subtle body is a presentation of the nervous system, from the Buddhist terms, the channels, chakras, and winds. So in the meditation texts, there's a presentation of these hollow channels based coming radiating out from a central channel and different chakras or wheels on those points, and within that flows wind energy. Now the wind energy flowing there is associated with mind. When the wind energy is sort of active in the sense organs, says gross sense consciousness. When we're going to sleep or when we're dying, the wind energy contracts from the peripheral channels and it enters the central channel. And as all the wind's getting more and more subtle, so the mind is getting more and more subtle. So the final visions before death are white vision, red vision, and black vision. So that is subtle mind associated with the subtle wind, the winds flowing in the central channel coming towards the heart chakra. Finally, they all absorb into the heart chakra. So you have the most subtle wind, the clear light wind, and the most subtle mind, the clear light mind, are experienced in relationship to this eternal drop, right? So that drop is the unity of subtle wind and subtle mind. When I say unity, it's not saying that they're the same thing, but they're the same entity which has two functions. It has movement, which is we label wind, and it has awareness, which we label mind. So it has always been there. It's not that when the gross mind is functioning that this clear light mind is not. It's there. It is functioning, but we're not aware of it. You know, it's too subtle. It's totally overwhelmed by the experience of everything else. So this entity, this eternal Brahman, is the most subtle wind, most subtle mind. And that, when one attains Buddhahood, the Buddha's mind is always at that clear light level. There is no coarse wind, no coarse mind at all. So that's why it says that when we die and our mind becomes more and more and more subtle down to the clear light, then we call that... So that's not different from a Buddha's mind in terms of what it is, but of course it's different from a Buddha's mind in that it's still contaminated by the seeds of ignorance, all the afflictions, and it bears karma. But karma and afflictions can be removed. They're not oneness with the mind. And so our clear light mind is our Buddha nature, or our Buddha potential to become enlightened. During life, we have the opportunity to purify the afflictions, to purify karma, and achieve true cessation, total extinguishment of the afflictions and destruction of karma. And so we continue purifying. The final point before attaining Buddhahood is to manifest the white vision and then extinguish the appearance, the false appearance of inherent existence of the white vision. Then red vision. We experience the red vision, focus upon that with the wisdom realizing emptiness, and we extinguish the false appearance of inherent existence. Similarly with the black vision. In the clear light state, there is never any appearance of inherent existence, even in our mind. So in our mind, when we're dying and we reach the final point of death, the clear light vision, for the first time in our life, there is no appearance of inherent existence. Unfortunately, that's not the wisdom directly realizing emptiness. If it were, we would be enlightened at death. Does that explain it? Right.
I think it's about the mind consciousness. Mind conscious, yeah. Okay, thanks. Thank you, Baba.
Okay. So that's why I've written here about karmic causality, that the potencies are borne by the mere person or the mere I, which is labelled upon the most subtle body and mind. So these have the potential to connect the person, you know, the gross person, with future pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral experiences. Which means that in future lives, every experience that one, like say as human beings, every experience we have is either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Which means our entire life is the reflection or the ripening of our karma, all the things that happen to us, all the things we experience. So, but even though our entire experience is a result of karmic causality, the mere existence of our body and the mere existence of our mind, these are the results of natural causality. You know, mind is not created by karma. Body is not created by karma. But the fact that we, the person, have a human body, that is karmic causality. Can you see the difference? Our bodies and result of karma. They're the result of natural activity. But the fact that you and I have human bodies, that is karmic result. that there is a connection between our mind and this human body. I have to think about that. Yeah.
But the body itself is a product of natural causes, as you said. So are you then referring to the biological aspect of it, the matter?
Yes.
Is that, so that's the difference, right? So the matter of the body is the result of the physical causes, but the fact that we are born as human beings is the karmic cause.
Yes.
Is that the difference?
That's the point.
Okay. So then if, say, we are born with a disability or super intelligent or whatever, that again would be part of the karmic cause, right?
Well, there could be a disability, a genetically determined disability, which would be a result of the genes, natural causality. But the fact that the individual has a physical disability is a karmic
cause. Is a karmic cause, yes. That's exactly what I wanted to clarify. Thank you very much.
Okay. Okay. So you hear the terms contaminated karma and uncontaminated karma. So when you see in the text the term contaminated karma, that refers to causal mental intentions arising from a mind contaminated by self-grasping ignorance, the fundamental ignorance which is manifest, and that creates contaminated karma. In general, when the term uncontaminated karma is used, this refers to causal mental intentions arising in the mind subsequent to direct realization of emptiness. So that means that the direct realization of emptiness in perfect single-pointed concentration has the power to stop ignorance from contaminating our actions. So the individual is not yet a Buddha, has just become an Arya being, entered the path of meditation, but the individual now has the mental power to not act upon the afflictions which are still in the mind. The seeds are still there, the gross ones have gone, but the afflictions are still there. And that's like His Holiness saying, well, I don't have anger, but sometimes there is an impulse to be angry, but I stop it. I don't manifest anger. So, what one would do is one would change consciously. One has the power to maintain the mind in virtue and act in a virtuous way according to the situation. So that is uncontaminated karma. Even though the seeds of ignorance and the other afflictions are still in the mind, the power of having realized emptiness initially enables one to override the impulse to act unskillfully. So that's uncontaminated karma. Okay. These points are coming out in order to really understand the wheel of life. So we're going to talk about them. The next is just a presentation of the different modes of dependent arising. So, Jeffrey Hopkins, he gave a talk which I attended at Dharamsala at the Benton library, and this was in the mid-70s, and as I tell people, up until the end of the 60s, there was no such thing as a slogan on T-shirts. All T-shirts were just plain, and they just began to happen towards the end of the 60s. And a friend of mine was a silk screen printer, and we produced some of the first ones, but I can't tell you the slogans that we produced. In Singapore, they'd lock me up. So, Jeffrey Hopkins said, if Buddha can have a slogan on your T-shirt, it'll be dependent arising. And this is the Buddha's slogan, according to Jeffrey Hopkins. So dependent arising refers to the conventional way of existence. So there's three levels. The first is arising in dependence upon causes and conditions, which is all products. We talked about that this morning. So that refers only to impermanent things, because to arise in dependence upon changing causes and conditions, then the products necessarily have the property of impermanence themselves. They're the result of impermanent things. So they change, they only last for a short moment, then they change and give rise to future results. So arising in dependence upon causes and conditions, substantial cause, cooperative conditions, karma. That refers to all impermanent things. The second is more subtle. It is arising in dependence upon its parts. So this can include all impermanent things as well as all permanent things. So, you know, the human body is something which exists in dependence upon its parts, the limbs, the trunk, the head, and so on. And when we look at any composed thing, you know, a clock exists in dependence upon the mechanism, the face, etc. And even permanent things, like space is just the mere absence of obstructive contact. But still, it can be divided up into the space in the north, the space in the south, space in the east, space in the west. So, directionally, we can talk about the component parts of space. And true cessation is, in general, true cessation refers to the cessation of afflictions. So there are many different types of true cessation, according to the afflictions which have come to an end. Emptiness itself. Emptiness depends upon its object. Like the emptiness of the bell is different from the emptiness of the clock. So they're both emptiness of inherent existence. But this is emptiness of inherent existence of a bell, emptiness of inherent existence of a clock. So there are different bases upon which emptiness exists. So that is dependence upon parts, and also you can include here things which exist in dependence upon comparison. Like we can say, you know, that this is a piece of string. That's all we can say about it. Well, we can talk about the components, but if we get another bit, which is this long, then this is a short piece of string in comparison to the long piece of string. And then we get another piece of string, only this long. This is long in comparison to that which is short. And like hot exists in dependence upon cold, and right in dependence upon left. So that's comparison. existing and depends upon comparison. Then the most subtle way of existing, which is refers to all things, both permanent and impermanent, is arising in dependence upon mental imputation. So things exist in dependence upon the name that we give them. And so we're talking about us wanting, you know, in our scientific investigation of reality, of how things exist, then we give them names. It's very clear, you know, in investigating the number of different species of animals, different families of animals, and so on, we're always giving them a name. And even this virus has now been given its proper name. Right. It's no longer coronavirus, da da da, 20. It's COVID 19. That is its official name. It now exists as that. We depend upon a name, like the person of this life. When we were born, before our parents gave us our name, the person, you know, if our name is Tom or Mary, then there was a baby born, a little boy, and the parents had not decided to give it a name, or decided upon a name. So it was just baby. New baby, or baby Smith, or whatever the parents' surname was. Then at the certain point where the parents decided, let's call him Tom, at that moment the person Tom Smith came into existence. And forever after, during that life, was always introduced as Tom. Come meet my friend Tom. This person is Tom. And so the other people got to know Tom through the appearance of a body which was suitable to be called Tom. And they correctly identified the person Tom. And there might be in a group a lot of people, and they see, they've only known Tom for a short while, and they see a familiar face, and they might think, oh, who's that person? Oh, I remember, that's Tom. Hello, Tom. So, correct. We identify the person Tom. Tom exists independent upon the name. But within that body, which is suitable to be called Tom, Tom cannot be found. Tom does not exist. The person Tom is not findable. On analysis, but without analyzing, it is correct to say that is the person Tom. So, conventional existence, independence upon mere imputation. And the same goes for every phenomenon throughout the entire universe, exists independence upon the name it's given. I was reading a description of Darwin's collection of evidence, and wondering how he could explain the great variety of species, and what the bit I was reading was explaining that Darwin had worked on farms, and he knew about the breeding of animals, cows and dogs and birds and so on, in order to breed good characteristics, better meat, whatever, in the animals. So he knew that through the selection of a type of animal which was, in their eyes, good. So you breed that animal with a similar type, and you get changing appearance of cows, dogs, etc. But he couldn't work out how to correlate that knowledge with the evidence he'd collected as he travelled around the world of the great variety of species. And what I read, what he was travelling in a cart being pulled by a horse in those days, and the roads were very bumpy. And this is what was said, that they went over a big bump and his notes flew into the air, and at that moment he had a eureka moment. Of course, natural selection. And so, in that moment, he coined the term natural selection was the explanation for evolution that he observed. So, I guess, at that moment, natural selection came into existence, independent upon the term. There was evolution, but it didn't have that label, natural selection. So whatever exists only exists conventionally, and existing independence upon the name, this is really subtle. How for us, and we're only talking about us, our human mind, our scientific, examining, exploring mind, we see things and we give them names, and upon the giving of the names, for us, the object comes into existence. We're not talking about what existed beforehand, we're talking about the communication of knowledge dependent upon names. And so when we check up, whatever exists, like Tom exists because we know conventionally his that face is suitable to be called Tom. But there is no Tom in there. Similarly, whatever exists only exists nominally. This third level of dependent arising is very profound, and that is what establishes things to exist conventionally for us. Nothing exists in its own right. When we label things, you know, this is an oxygen atom, and we know, what is it, 8 protons, I can't remember, 8 protons, 8 neutrons, and electrons whizzing around, that is suitable to be called oxygen. But if we look at that collection of 8 protons, 8 neutrons, 8 electrons, we can't find oxygen. And they can be separated and go into different elements. There's no oxygen. Oxygen is only conventionally exists in dependence upon the label that somebody gave to such a type of atom. And it goes for everything in the entire universe. Whatever we analyze and check up for the thing which is identified by its name can't be found. But without analysis, we can talk about things functioning. This collection of 8 protons, 8 neutrons can function as an oxygen atom. It is oxygen. Without analyzing. Analyze? No oxygen in its own right. This is the most critical point in Buddhist teachings, that you, me, everything, we only exist nominally, conventionally. And that does not mean we don't exist at all. We can't be found upon ultimate analysis. But we can be found and we can function conventionally. Tom can function. Tom, the person merely labelled upon that body, Tom functions as Tom. Anyway, we might come back to emptiness later on. The final sentence on that page: emptiness of inherent existence of all things is there ultimate nature or way of existence? Whatever exists is one entity with its own emptiness. You know, we hear in, or we read in the Heart Sutra, form is emptiness, emptiness is form. That does not mean that form is emptiness, emptiness is form. They're different. Right? Emptiness is the mere absence of inherent existence. Form is solid things which have physical characteristics. But let's say the clock. The clock is form, you know, it's a physical phenomenon. So the functioning clock is one entity with the emptiness of inherent existence of the clock, which means that the ultimate nature of the clock is emptiness of inherent existence. Conventional nature is this functioning instrument. In the Heart Sutra, you know, form covers all physical things, is emptiness, emptiness is form, then this clock is an example of form because it's suitable to be called form. And it's emptiness because it's empty of inherent existence, the form, the component parts, plastic, etc., can appear as form, as a clock. If the component parts existed inherently, they would not be able to change. They would not be able to be collectively called clock. In other words, if Tom were inherently existing as he appears to our minds, the parents would not need to have given the name Tom to the new baby. Tom would have come with the baby. But the baby, to be identified as Tom, needed to be given the label Tom. And when this body and mind cease at the end of life, the person Tom ceases to exist, but the mere person, the mere I, the most subtle wind and mind in the eternal drop, carries on with all of the qualities of Tom's mind. It's not Tom's mind which goes on to the future life, because Tom's mind was the gross mind associated with the person Tom. But Tom has ceased to exist at death. His body is no longer Tom. It used to be, it was suitable to be called the person Tom when it was connected with mind, but then it just became a lump of flesh and bones which decayed, and, you know, earth, ashes to ashes, dust to dust. So that's no longer Tom. You know, it's not when we have the ashes of our dead relatives in an urn. Now that's not mum or dad. That's just ashes. Mum or dad have ceased to exist, and they're not in heaven waiting to meet us again. Yeah. Some people think even their dead pets are in heaven waiting for them to meet up with again. It's not like that. The person ceases. The merely labelled person stops when the basis which is suitable to be bear their name stops. And so the mind that used to be called Tom's mind is now an in between, or a between the mind of a between Bardo body, which is the shape of the future life. And so that future life is this human. Well, it might be called Tom in the future life, but probably not. And it could be any type of life in the wheel of life. Okay. So that sets the ground for talking about the 12 links of dependent origination on the second page. And they're just mentioned here, the 12 links, which are usually done in a circle because they're circular. So this shows the interdependence of one thing arising in dependence upon a prior thing. So the prior link is the cause or gives rise to the subsequent link. So we begin with ignorance, which is the self-grasping ignorance that is in our minds, has been in our minds since beginning this time. So where you have a mind contaminated by ignorance, then that gives rise to the other afflictions of attachment, anger, pride, jealousy, and so on, as well as virtuous mental factors of generosity, compassion, wisdom, love. But although that virtue is contaminated virtue, because they are virtuous mental factors in a mind contaminated by ignorance. So we are constantly performing actions, intended actions. Our mind has the mental factor of intention, and we do things which may be virtuous actions out of kindness, love, generosity, whatever, or we do non-virtuous actions. So this is karmic creation or volition, and that is the second link. So ignorant minds give rise to actions, which is the second link, karmic creation. We're just going through these generally, not in the sequence, but to explain them. So as we've already explained, an intentional action, we'll talk about karmic causality, so that refers to the intention behind the actions. So constantly, all the time, there is an intention in our mind, moment by moment. We have intentions. We have intentions to be here in this room. We have intentions to do other things. Intention is always present in our mind, whatever we're doing. Intention is the purposeful activity of linking our mind with the object which we're interested in, which the mind is observing. So our mind is always experiencing. So there's intention to experience. Now, the second link, karmic formation, refers to actions where, as when we talked about karma, remember the four branches complete. There's the object of the action, there's the motivation, which includes the intention, there's the action itself, which will be physical, verbal, or mental, and there's the result or the completion of the action. So there's four branches. So when you have volition or karmic formation, I put in the shorter word volition because karmic formation made it too long. Made the line too long. So, but it means the same thing. You have the karmic action which leads to a potency being established on the stream of consciousness. And that potency we call a karmic potency. Right? So the third link is called consciousness. And what it's referring to is the consciousness from the time that particular karmic potency is placed upon it and then born through time as a potential without ripening. So up until the time when it gives rise to its result, its specific result. So in the 12 links, we are talking about every single karmic action we perform has its own set of 12 links. So, ignorance refers to the link ignorance, which gives rise to a specific karmic action and which creates a specific karmic potential upon the mind stream. So now we're following that karmic potential, this set of 12 links, which means as our mind contains countless karmic potentials from past lives and from this life, we're creating new karmic potentials every time we have intended actions. We are actually experiencing countless 12 links, countless sets of 12 links all the time. But now we're following just one of those. So one particular action creates a potency born on the consciousness link. That then, so now this particular potency, when it ripens, and it can be quite complicated, it can ripen in conjunction with many others, but let's say the one that we are following in this set of 12 links, it ripens or is ripened during the death process, and then whilst we still have some capacity of discrimination, and then we have this subtle experience, and then we die, and so that ripened, germinated karmic potency is the cause of the between state body and mind. So the bardo is now its shape, its type, whether it's hell being, hungry ghost, animal, human, divine being, is determined by that karmic potency that ripened. So eventually the bardo being is attracted to its rebirth state, and then you have rebirth with a new body and mind. So that is the link between the consciousness link, which bore the karmic potency, and the body and mind of the future life. You see the connection? The mere eye, the most subtle wind of mind, entered a particular animal or human or whatever it was, and was born into a new life as a result of the karmic potency. So the first moment of after conception, right? Conception has occurred, and the third thing, apart from the sperm and the ovum, is stream of consciousness, all uniting in the fertilized egg in the mother's womb. Then you have the next link, the body and mind. So the body is the gross body, is the genetic materials from the parents, and all the nutrients that the developing embryo will absorb from the placenta. The subtle body is the subtle wind which came with the subtle mind from the bardo. The mind is the clear light mind coming from the bardo, bearing all of the positive and negative potentials and qualities. Then that became more coarse as the embryo developed into the fetus in the womb. So there's still a continuity. So when the fetus has developed to the point where its five physical senses and the mental sense are all capable of functioning, that then is the link called the six sources. So a source means source for consciousness. So, still in the womb, you're not aware of the outside environment, but the eyes, you have the source for eye consciousness. When you are born, you open your eyes, you are able to perceive the outside world, And so you have eye consciousness, your ears, smell, taste, touch. You have the five senses, the five sources capable of experiencing the outer environment. And the sixth sense, the mental consciousness, also is ready to think about the outside world. So the six sources, these, that link occurs in the womb from the time we have a viable fetus up until the actual birth. An actual birth emerging from the womb gives rise to the next link, contact. Contact, I mean direct contact of the sense organs with the external objects, the objects of the external world. So you have contact with not only sense objects, but you have mental contact with your ideas and emotions and so on. Because we have contact, we necessarily contact pleasant things, unpleasant things, and neutral things. Every sensory experience, every thought experience is either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. So there's feeling. We can't help but have feeling. Just as we can't help having had contact. And we can't help having contact because we've got the six sources. And we can't help having the six sources because we have this new body and mind. And we can't help having a new body and mind because a karmic potency ripened upon the consciousness. We can't help having karmic potencies because there was ignorance behind the creation of the karmic potency. So you see, this is the connectivity between the links. Now, because there's feeling of pleasure or displeasure or neutral feeling upon that inescapable contact, there's craving. The next link, craving refers craving to have more contact with pleasant things, craving to be separated from unpleasant things. So you have attraction and aversion. Then you live your whole life experiencing attraction and aversion. Now, so our whole lives revolve around feelings, the pursuit of pleasant feelings, and the avoidance of unpleasant feelings. And there's every right we have. We have equal rights as humans to experience pleasure and to not experience pain. There's nothing wrong with experiencing pleasure and avoiding experiencing pain itself. But because of craving, attachment and aversion, we create karma. Because we still have ignorance. So, you see, due to craving, we create more karmic potencies throughout life. Our entire life has been the ripening of other karmic potencies in terms of pleasant, unpleasant and neutral experiences. But instead of bringing an end to our karma, we cannot help but generate attachment to pleasure and therefore desire and greed and miserliness, all of the afflictions associated with desire. And when we have pain and unpleasant experiences, we have no, because of ignorance and self-cherishing, we can't help but to generate irritability, anger, hatred, spitefulness, all of the afflictions associated with aversion. And so we create more karma, so more second links of volition or karmic formation are established upon the mind stream. So many more. Every moment of our life, we're creating more. We're experiencing, others are being exhausted as we experience them, others are being created. Then, towards the end of life, there's grasping. Grasping at existence. Not wanting to disappear, not wanting to die. So this is just an intensified form of attachment. And as we're approaching death, it is that strong grasping at existence, at life, at rebirth, if we're aware of rebirth. We don't want to stop. We don't want to be annihilated. We want to live. So that incredible mental energy nurtures another karmic potency for a future life. That germinates. That is the what germinates a future karmic potency during the death experience. And then, as a result of that germination, when we die, the eternal drop, the clear light wind of mind, the most subtle body and mind, are propelled through yet another between Bardo existence to another rebirth. And as a result of that rebirth, inevitably we're experiencing aging and death. And at death, there are the links of sorrow, lamentation, grief, unhappiness, and mental disturbance. So that's like a brief tour through the 12 links, and you can see how they're connected. Now we're going to go into them in a bit more detail to understand them. Understanding the 12 links, there are many stories of how Buddha's disciples, just hearing the causality behind the 12 links, they achieved nirvana, or achieved many levels of the path. They obviously were well primed, but it was just this, as where it all clicked, of course, you know. I think there were eureka moments, like when Darwin's notes went up in the air and he said, of course, natural selection. Like he'd done all of the groundwork, thinking, you know, observing the variation in species, but he couldn't quite put it together. How did it happen? Evolution through natural selection, not through man-made breeding of species of farm animals, but through natural selection, survival of the fittest. So this whole picture of evolution fell into place. So a lot of Buddha's disciples, they just said, 12 links of dependent origin, of course. Nirvana, incredible. Okay. Any questions? Oh, yeah.
Does the 12 links apply to the format problems?
Apply to the
format problems?
The what?
The format problems?
So good.
Does the 12 links applies to the form and the formless realm? Or your form and the formless realm?
Does the 12 links apply to the form and
formless? Yes. The rebirth in the form and formless realms is a result of karma. Yeah, 12 links.
But I thought that formless realm, there is no body, there's no body and there's no six sources, right?
There is no gross body in the formless realm. There is a subtle body in the form realm. You do not create karma in the form and formless realms, but you experience they are karmic results, and the mind still carries karmic potencies from past lives. And so when the karma for birth in the form and formless realms is exhausted and they die, they get this craving and so they get rebirth at other levels. They think that they've got out of it. But they have a rude shock when they start to die. Yeah.
Is volition the result of karmic potentialities, or is it volition that causes karmic potentialities to occur?
Yes, volition, the second link, which we call volition, the term volition refers to the intention, which is creates the karma, right? So karmic creation.
So intention causes motivation, motivation causes volition?
The intention is an intended, refers to an action, the body, speech, or mind, under intention, so volition. So when you do, say you see a hungry dog, you have compassion, so you give some food. So that is the karmic creation of a virtuous karmic potency. So once the dog has received the food and you're happy about having helped it, that action ceases, but it doesn't disappear. It becomes a karmic potency born upon the consciousness. So that's why the third link is called consciousness, but it's not the mind. It is the mind bearing the karmic potency. That's the third link.
So then, how are intention and motivation different, or are they the same, and how are they connected with?
Well, motivation includes more than the mental factor of intention. In the example, it included compassion. So compassion is a separate mental factor. And compassion is virtuous. So the intention was virtuous. The whole motivation, collectively, was a virtuous motivation. So it created a virtuous karmic potency. Where there is anger, like you see a dog and you don't like it, so you throw a stone at it, wanting to hurt it, then the intention, which is neither virtuous nor non-virtuous, that became associated with anger. So the whole mind, including the whole motivation, was non-virtuous. So that created a non-virtuous potency.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Is emptiness related to dependent origination?
Is emptiness related to dependent origination? You bet. Yeah. So absolute is a bad word. Most definitely. Yeah, so the question is emptiness related to dependent arising, right? So the meaning of dependent arising is that whatever exists does not exist in its own right, but exists in dependence upon other things, right? The meaning of emptiness is that whatever exists does not exist in its own right, it exists in dependence upon other things. It's empty of self-existence. So the meaning of emptiness indicates the meaning of dependent arising, and the meaning of dependent arising indicates the meaning of emptiness. That's just looking at it from two sides of the coin. So again, and this is really important, if we use the syllogism. Whatever exists, it does so. Whatever exists, that's an affirmative, exists independence, is empty of inherent existence, that's a negation, because it exists in dependence upon causes and conditions. So you have an affirmation, and you have a negation, and you have a reason. Whatever exists is empty of inherent existence because it exists, again, the affirmation, in dependence upon other things. So inherent existence is existing in its own right, independent of everything. Nothing exists. Everything is empty of existing in that way, but it's not empty of existing at all, because it exists in dependence upon other. So yeah, absolutely, they indicate each other.
So you can't have one without the other.
Sorry?
You can't have one without the other.
No, that's right. They are two qualities of every phenomenon.
Okay.
The conventional reality of the clock exists and is empty of inherent existing because it exists in dependence upon causes and conditions. So, if it existed independent of causes and conditions, it would be a clock all the time. You wouldn't have to call it clock.
Okay. And the other thing I'm struggling with is this concept of beginninglessness.
Beginningless, yeah.
Because it seems like if you had some physical phenomenon, I don't know, a person, a star, an atom, right? It seems like it would have to come into existence at some point, but then you said, like, something can't come from nothing either.
Right.
So, I guess I have to think about beginninglessness a lot longer.
Yeah. So if the atom came into existence and it didn't come from another atom, where did it come from?
From its parts?
From
its parts?
Its parts.
Its parts.
Parts, yeah.
Yeah, like it comes together because the neutrons and the protons and the electrons all are from natural causes, right?
Yeah, sure. So where did they come from?
I don't know, their parts?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, as far back as you go, you can see causality, natural causality, just pure on the scientific side. I mean, even now there's a lot of doubt about such a thing as a Big Bang. It's just a theory. And there are many serious questions that arise of the entire universe coming from nothing. And I think that they are leaning towards prior something giving rise to the Big Bang. It could have been something like a Big Bang, but it wasn't the beginning from nothing. The Buddha often, at times, he was asked this question about beginningless, endlessness, and he just sat silent. He did not answer the question. He said, "You people," he said, "in my omniscient mind, I cannot see a beginning, I cannot see an end. You, if I give you an answer, you're going to intellectually argue about it until the end of your life, and you're not going to use your life to observe karma." And yeah, he said, "Look, sophistry and arguments will go on forever and ever, and you have this precious opportunity to observe cause and effect here and now, and don't waste it. And you'll get to know as your mind approaches omniscience.
So doesn't beginninglessness, like, because we can't quite fathom it, then maybe that's where we create a God?
Yes.
To start everything.
We want a beginning. And I think human societies all over the world have proposed a creator. But that always begs the question, where did the creator come from? And why did the creator create such an awful world? If the creator, he or she, was so clever, could have done a much better job. So Buddhism definitely, in India at the time of Buddha, the general idea was that everything was created by Brahma. And it's really interesting because Buddhism said Brahma exists. And we had a talk earlier in my stay here about the cosmic theory of evolution, or the presentation of the cosmos from the Buddhist point of view, that we could talk about our galaxy definitely had a beginning. And so it says that in our region of the universe, there are many throughout the universe there are many galaxies coming and going at different phases. Some are in the developmental phase, some are in the abiding phase, some are declining, and some are just supernova or empty. So four phases. Empty phase, when there's no planets, solar systems. Empty phase, then formation phase, when a galaxy is developing. Abiding phase, and then destruction phase. And so these are equal duration of time, and they go forever, like repetitively. The empty phase follows a destruction phase. And there are always sentient beings. During the period of destruction, the sentient beings in that corner of the universe are no longer creating karma for rebirth in the lower realms as animals, hell beings, hungros, humans, desire realms. They're all being reborn at what we were talking before about the form and formless realms, where there's no gross body. There are subtle bodies, but not as bodies like our own. And so they abide for incredible long durations of that meditative experience. So that's during the period of emptiness. There still exists in that corner of the universe the most minute particles of matter, which in the Kala Chakra Tantra they're called space particles, and which quantum physics calls space particles as well. They say that space is particulate, it's granular matter. So that's the period of emptiness. Then the karma for those beings declines, and they start being reborn, still form and formless, but lower levels, and correspondingly to that declining karma, there's wind and water and fire and earth. There's aggregation of these particles into grosser and grosser until you get stars and planets and solar systems and so on. So that's the period of development. So these sentient beings who are being born in the lowest form realm is called the realm of Brahma. And so they're getting reborn down into that realm. And then correspondingly, there's through natural causality, there's the development of solar systems, suns and planets, and suitable environments for existence as we know it, animal, plant, human, and hungry ghosts and hells and desire realm gods. So from the realm of Brahma, dying from there, then as the suitable conditions arise for embodied life as we know it on these new planets, you get the evolution of species. And so everybody comes from Brahma. Like the humans do come from Brahma. So we came from Brahma. And there's periods where there's coexistence of the desire realm beings and the early humans. The early humans are nothing like we are. They were like gods, bodies of light. They don't consume foods. They exist in the through the power of meditation alone that supports them. Meanwhile, there's physical evolution. So probably, and the way I see it, is that the first life forms were like single-celled entities arising from the primordial soup, but which weren't conscious. But then, as single-celled entities began to join, and at that stage, they became suitable supports for consciousness. And not deliberately, but through death from the higher levels, sentient beings were reborn as these most primitive multicellular animals. And so they had very primitive consciousness according to their capacity to be aware. But they all had the potent potentials for the sense consciousness and for mental consciousness. They had the Buddha nature. Then as physical life became more and more complex, the bodies became more capable of engaging in the world through eyes, ears, smell, taste and touch. And why? Because it's called the desire realm because the reason for being born in this gross embodied existence is desire for sensory pleasure. So if we look at evolution from the point of view not that our nervous systems and sense organs are the result of natural causes, but if we look at desire for sensory pleasure, we look at the types of animals that have arisen, well, what are they doing in their lives? What are we doing? What do we live for? We live for pleasure. And we live to be free from pain. That is the overwhelming energy, or what is it? Reason for living. For us, for dogs, cats, mosquitoes, all animals. It's not so much for reproduction. Reproduction is part of it, it's the greatest pleasure. But still, who gives a damn about our genes? I want the pleasure. So, this is my personal, the Gyatso formulation for evolution. That conscious desire for sensory pleasure is the cause of evolution, not the result. Scientifically, mind is a result of evolution. And sensory organs are just there to survive. But I think our sense organs are here to enjoy. Anyway, more about that tomorrow when we're going into detail on the 12 links and the what was come up just now I think is a very interesting point to think about in terms of the 12 links. Okay, so we began this morning with the long meditation, the most important thing of today has been the meditation on generating loving kindness for all beings. So we should try to remember the feeling that we had, that warmth of genuine love, and try to not let it fade away. Don't let it die out, but revive it throughout the day. Just look at people and see them in an affectionate light, that they're, maybe you can't see them as your mother, your father, but they're somebody else's mother, somebody else's father. And they have these qualities, these natural qualities of caring for each other, of compassion and kindness, not only to their children, but for each other. So try to see living beings in that light and keep the flame of love alive. You know, I think about evolution, you know, when humans probably first started using fire, then fire became very precious. And you know, we think they must have, particularly in cold climates, you know, you get a fire going, so you keep it with you all day as burning embers. Probably somebody's responsibility was to keep the embers burning, because it kept you alive. We needed fire. So keep the embers of love and kindness alight and glowing in your minds 24 hours a day, and then life will be really worth living. So dedicate our positive energy of today to keeping the home fires burning in our hearts. Thank you so much.